Hi everyone, you're listening to Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. This show is all about building a hub of relevant, insightful, and actionable business insights that can help drive greater performance and innovation. I've worked with several tech startups myself and know from experience that success is underpinned by a passion for continual learning and growth. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity to speak with our guests and learn from their stories. If you enjoy this podcast, you can download the free ebook featuring my personal podcast highlights from the past 2 years at www.venturi-group.com/podcast-ebook. If you're looking for more information on today's episode, just head over to the Venturi website to check out the show notes. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Jamie Graves, the CEO at Zone Fox.
Just for a bit of clarity, I founded two companies, but they basically do the same thing. So Inquisitive Systems is the one I founded out of university. I did my PhD, founded that, span it out, and ZoneFox is the subsidiary we created to really develop and build out. Now, Inquisitive Systems will be around forever, and we'll do lots of other ideas with that, but ZoneFox is my main passion at the moment, which is about insider threat. But to your original question, I don't know if I'm the classic entrepreneurial type. I guess it depends on what that is. I guess what I am is someone who really likes to explore. I'm very inquisitive. I'm very curious about things, and I like to follow the road wherever it goes and take forks in the road should they appear. I don't really have a plan other than chase the star.
Right. Well, I think it's the best plan there is, though, in a lot of instances, right? I think people get caught up too much in following the things you're supposed to do. And I think that kind of following what your interests are generally takes you to good places.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I am today. So I got the opportunity to do a PhD with the Professor Buchanan, who helped formulate some of the base ideas that we worked on together, and then we founded a company together, and that was again another opportunity to go out and do something that I hadn't planned on doing, and here we are today, you know, 7-8 years later, with a company we've got just under 30 people, we've got lots of really interesting customers, we've got deployments across the world, it's an amazing place to be in.
So obviously it's technology focused. Was your initial interest in technology, or was it more from the kind of the business side where you would consider your sort of background to be?
My background's in security and computers, and really the interest came from the fact that back in 2005 when I started doing my PhD work, we were in a position where people were getting locked up or fired from their jobs based on pretty poor evidence, pretty poor descriptions of their activities that has led to an incident or allegedly led to an incident. And so I set out to try and find what I guess you could call would be an ideal form of evidence or description for that. And purely not to incriminate or do anything else, but just to, you know, provide the truth or the reality of the situation. And so we started that 2005, 2008, finished my PhD, and we got additional funding and you know, went through the usual startup stuff. And if I think about it, it was 10 years, it was 2015, we got approached by a very large company, and they found that, well, they thought that someone was stealing something from them. It was a database administrator. I can't go into too many details because you'd be able to tell who the company is. But long story short, we managed to prove it wasn't him, but his account had got hacked, and it was someone from the Far East pretending to be him to steal information. And so it took me 10 years to get to that point, but the thing that I thought about, invented, and brought to market, and then sold, and then deployed, finally helped someone keep their job. And I was really stoked about that. And that's what keeps me going a lot of the time, which is we're doing good here.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's creating something with a purpose, isn't it? And that's probably consistent through whatever you do. I think that if you're motivated by the outcome as opposed to, I suppose you can be motivated by both, but I think it's almost more important to be motivated by the outcomes and then kind of learning the skills that are necessary to resolve those outcomes in the meantime. It's something that a lot of technical people, I think, may struggle with on a different capacity to yourself, but maybe, you know, they're employed, they're working in securities or whatever their technical discipline is. They work for the technical reasons and they don't have that kind of understanding of what you're working towards necessarily. You need clarity on that, don't you?
Yes, it's the business objectives. It's why does the company or why do you help customers in the first place? And I think you've got a good point, which is a lot of technical people, and I was including this until I got a lot of good mentoring and good support from some great people in the local community, do see technology as a means to an end. But then you realize from a business level, it's a tool, it's an enabler to allow the business to do something, which is, you know, make money or execute their mission or whatever it is. And if you can start to translate that, then you're in a far better position.
Indeed, mate, indeed. And when you, I suppose, approach the things that you've built, and even maybe in your kind of PhD work, was it difficult to not get kind of sidetracked, or was it quite easy to stay focused on the vision, the end goal? And do you kind of attribute that to any successes that, you know, that you had that kind of ability to stay focused? And was that a constant battle? I think that with what's going on in technology, the amount of different advancements, the rate of change of technology at the moment, it's so easy to get distracted. Was that something that you found particularly difficult, you know, even through the PhD years?
Distraction's always there. I think if people say they don't struggle with it, I don't think they tell you the truth. Everyone gets distracted, but as you pointed out, it's how you deal with it, right? It's that methodology or that thing that you don't know if it's a methodology at first. It's maybe more of a gut instinct, which is I'm wasting my time here, or I've experimented with this, and what's the purpose of this distraction, and will it help me with my main goal or my main mission in life? And I did a bunch of stuff that contributed absolutely nothing to my work, but it was there to satisfy curiosity, to make sure I was doing the right thing in other areas and make sure that I didn't go down an avenue that would be a dead end or you know, that the whole thing about doing a PhD is it's a fundamentally creative process, and it's documenting that creativity and having experiments and analysis and insights to show how you've contributed to the knowledge of mankind. And that's inherently creative, and it's a difficult path to stay on. But if you can set out your hypothesis, your goal at the very start, and for me it was that, very much that, what does this ideal form of evidence look like, then that always pulls you back to that center of the road that you need to stay on to complete the journey.
Doing a PhD in general actually is quite interesting, because not a lot of technical people go down that road in the first place. But what was it for you that was kind of, it made sense for you to do? What about that option was, I suppose, most appealing?
It was there. It was my magpie nature. It was, I'll try this because it sounds interesting. I was curious. I wanted to try it out. I just completed my degree. I got the opportunity to work with a really interesting person, and there's some really interesting stuff around. So I absolutely leapt at it.
Right, right. Well, why do you think more people don't in technology? I mean, I think maybe it seems quite obvious, but why do you think a lot of technical people now aren't looking as much at the traditional educational paths? I mean, there's a lot of academies and such now that people are turning to instead of the traditional educational methods. Why do you think people are kind of veering away from that, or are they? I suppose.
I think you raise a really good point, which is I think the academy or even the technical school idea is brilliant, and I don't think we do enough of that, because as part of doing the PhD, I went out and I taught students, and there were a lot of students who were on this degree course that I was teaching. They had to write, but they were taught how to do classic research, which is literature reviews and looking at prior art and other research and compare and contrast. And a lot of these people, they just wanted to get their hands into the technology. They were really, really passionate about that. And I don't think everyone's really has the desire to do that kind of traditional research. It's important. Research is incredibly important, but I don't know if we should be putting everyone through that particular approach. And so when I think about some of the things some of the comments that students would come back to me, which is, why do I do this? I find that this is pointless. And part of that was kind of coaching them through that and trying to help them see that. But sometimes, you know, it's an age thing. Sometimes you see that when you're older in life, maybe you've had other experiences, but other times you're impatient and you want to get your hands on the tech and apply it and do really cool stuff with it as well. And it's a balance, right? But I think that the approach of academies, so in Edinburgh, we've got something called Code Clan. It's a 16-week intensive coding course. And they've got a fantastic hit rate. I mean, they take people in from all kinds of backgrounds. And, you know, people who used to be plumbers or hairdressers or whatever, with no coding experience, they train them up to be programmers. And these people really, really want to do this. And that's part of it. And they manage to do it in a process that isn't distracting. So going back to your previous point about what's a distraction, I think some of the classic academic stuff can be a distraction to some people. But that approach we see to work really well, and we see some great graduates from that particular project.
It's interesting. It's very interesting. I think that the way that people are educated in general, for me, is something that I'm really interested in, actually. And I think that we talk about disruption. I think that for me is the next thing that I'd like to see disrupted, is this like overpriced, diminishing returns education system that we currently have. And that's kind of my personal take on it. And I think that, you know, you have to look at technology, these coding, these intensive academies as, as a viable option. They're way cheaper. You know, they're focused on people, what people actually want to learn. You know, and I think that there's going to be a lot more people going down that kind of road. And I think, you know, you look at something as complex as programming or development, it's difficult. It's a difficult thing to learn. And I think that you still need that brick and mortar and you need that support from people. But I think we're getting to the point where things are getting better and better online. The experiences online are going to be able to continuously improve. And hopefully that will, really help and counter some of these long-standing institutions that, you know, I mean, what other industry can get away with, continuously increasing prices when the return is much less now? You know, I mean.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues there, which is one is it was seen as a one-size-fits-all solution, which is let's get everyone through university. And there was no consideration about the impact that would have on the universities themselves. And the other is the fact that, yeah, you're right, it's incredibly expensive. And the old model was you'd have a job for life or you'd have a longer-term career. But we're starting to see loads of people. It's just not true anymore. You're going to change your career a couple of times. We're trying to do that. We're trying to embrace that, which is we're working with lots of young people who we expect to leave and then take some of their experience with them and hopefully come back again. But we want to encourage them to leave at some point. Go away, learn what you can learn, and then if you like working here, then please do come back and teach us some stuff that you had in the industry, but mostly be ambassadors for ZoneFox because, you know, it's a great company and all that kind of good stuff. So back to the university thing, they've not, you know, they've still definitely got a place because you need research, you need that element, and there are people who thrive in that environment. But you're right, the online piece is really interesting, and universities are starting to do that as well. You've got universities with their online courses, their ability to have that international reach and get graduates enrolled. But it's almost as if they're replicating their existing model and they've not gone far enough to a newer kind of progressive business model where, you know, I can imagine a local university here offering the same as Code Clan with access to amazing teachers and access to amazing content. But they do the same thing over and over again, and you're right, it's ripe for disruption.
Yeah, I think so. And there's a hierarchy still a little bit there as well, that needs the disruption. So there's a responsibility on the organizations as well, to kind of to change the way they think about, I suppose, the onboarding process. So I think it will change with time. And I don't think it's a million miles away, but it's certainly something I'd like to see change. And I think, you know, for people in technology specifically, and obviously we, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do on the commercial side is recruitment for IT talent. And, you know, it's, you still get organizations that are like, oh, he's got to have a degree. It's like, well, you know, there's like hardly anyone in this discipline that goes and gets a degree anymore, right? But they still kind of want that, which I don't, you know, which I think will, it's becoming less and less as like that's what people want, but it's still kind of there in people's thinking.
Yeah. Well, like a data science degree, which is really, really difficult to find. And, you know, everyone wants data scientists nowadays, but what is a data scientist and all that kind of stuff that goes with it?
Right, right. Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, how do you learn that at university, right? I mean, how are you getting the lecturers and the talent who are motivated to go in and lecture about these sort of things, you know, who are experts in the field? Or...
Yeah, and it's usually people with other degrees. So people done maths or physics or statistics or even, you know, various other disciplines, they can turn their hand incredibly well. And I think that's also a fascinating angle as well, where we've interviewed a lot of devs over our time, and it's not necessarily those with a development background that are the best. It's the problem solvers. And so for me, a degree nowadays is just an indication of a type of background, but it's not really an indication of mindset, which is kind of what we're looking for.
Yeah. You know, aside from a kind of disruptive tendencies as well, you know, now you're focused on, you know, ZoneFox, for example, or the product. You know, how difficult is that? You know, I'm really curious now, because it's got to be something that you need, a product now that you constantly have to adapt, especially if it's a technical product, right? It's got to be something that you're constantly adapting and changing. You know, I wonder whether sometimes the product, how similar the product looks from, you know, when you first built it to now, and how much that you're having to change the product over the years. And I suppose the outcomes will probably be the same, right? So solving security problems, but aside from that, you know, the how quickly are products changing now, you know, these technical products?
Incredibly quickly. It's funny you should bring up the idea of what the product looked like. We've got on one of our internal systems, we've got what we call the ZoneFox Museum, which has every screenshot of every user interface we've ever been through from day one through to, well, what we have right now. And we use it to go back and have a think about where we've come from. I have a bit of a laugh as well, because some of them were terrible in the early days. I mean, you know, our first version was literally a command prompt that just spat data at you. And I don't know how we managed to do it, but people were like, yeah, it's really cool. We can get some value from this. So that was something. Yeah, I mean, products are changing a lot. I mean, you've got your development methodologies that release something every 2 weeks, or, you know, go for a major release every period as well. And certainly within our space, enterprise software is slightly difficult to update in the same rapid manner as, say, a website. It's slightly more difficult to do things like A/B testing, for example, in order to get some insights into what's working, what's not working. But these techniques are still useful. They still allow us to tune the product and provide better insights. You're right in that the fundamental core philosophy and ideas around the product are the same, but the way it's packaged and presented and reveals those insights have changed over the years, going from I guess a philosophy of showing some data to showing information, and then showing useful information, and then actionable information, and then how do you do something with this information? So it's an evolution of an idea along that spectrum, and that's adding new capabilities to it. But I think it's interesting seeing the way products develop over the years, where at first it's about getting traction, it's about getting minimal viable product, and you're stuffing features into the product, and you're hoping things will stick. And then you get to a point where you think, wait a minute, we need to stop all this, because actually this is not being used and that's not being used, and it looks like a bit of a mess. And what do we strip out, and how do we streamline this to make sure you get the best, most effective experience that you can? And really you go into that optimization phase at that point. But also keeping in mind the fact that, as you say, things are rapidly changing. You know, we're thinking about various other monitoring channels. So how do we get other bits of data in, and what use is that data to our customers, and what key problem is that solving for them? So it's a real balance. It's a really interesting challenge. And what we did at the start of the year is we got our new head of product in. And that's really allowed us to split out the proper functions across the team. So engineering, working with product, marketing, working with product, sales, working with product. Then I'm working with product as well to make sure that the vision for the product is still there, but you've got all these competing priorities and voices across the team to gain access to that person.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously not on a product anymore, but I've worked on products in the past, and it's a fascinating thing and something that I do miss now and again, and then I also don't miss it sometimes when you consider bugs and all the kind of rest of it that you have to sit through. So it's interesting, and in the security space at the minute as well. I mean, it's got to be quite a thriving space. I mean, we've seen the press that it's had. You know, the NHS one comes to mind. You know, there's got to be just an absolute people crying out for security solutions at the moment. And is that something that's always been there, or are we? Is it in a particular growth phase at the moment?
Yeah, it's growing at a stunning rate. You look at the security startups around, you think about London, and you've got the security incubator there, and you've got some security startups up here. And then you look at the US, you look at Israel, and there's hundreds of startups out there solving very particular problems. And that's because we have a real issue. I mean, even 10 years ago, I'm thinking 2007, 2008, we'd have some news around data breaches, but not much. But that's just completely been outpaced in the past few years, where each year we've had bigger and bigger numbers with, you know, Yahoo the other year with their 4 billion users being compromised. And the numbers are just staggering. And it's a real problem. It's I wouldn't say it's a crisis yet, but we do have some significant challenges. And yes, people are calling out for security solutions. But again, we've got to think about the business need and the business context, and the board is changing. So senior leadership starting to get the security issue, which is great. But then you've got to fit it in with everything else a business does, which is, you know, you can't tear out a network and redesign it and then re-implement it easily, because they've got to do their day-to-day activities. And if you look at the WannaCry outbreak the other month, which affected the NHS so badly, people were criticizing IT admins for not patching the systems quickly enough. But when you dig into that, you think, yeah, that's really stupid. But you dig into the operational reasons for it, and people go, well, I couldn't because the business still wants me to run this type of software, and I haven't had a chance to test this patch on it. And my experience from the past shows me that patches have destroyed that bit of software, and I've gotten into trouble over it. So there's still that issue down at the operational level about providing organizations with the ability to update their systems quickly. So yes, there's a need for it. Yes, there's lots of stuff you can do around it, but there's still some snags. I'd say it's more than snags. I'd say some major challenges about getting systems updated and doing the basic hygiene stuff within the context of day-to-day business operations.
So is as much of it in security as well as it is obviously offering the solutions, at kind of a more complex level. Is part of it just education as well for people? Maybe the technology has just moved so quickly that people haven't been educated enough on how to properly secure themselves. Do you think that is still a big part of it?
Yeah, education is massive. And it's one of the things you're starting to see a lot more companies focusing on, or some startups addressing. So if I think about the phishing education, where people will buy in the services of a phishing team, where they'll send emails to your employees, and your employees, if they click on the links, then they will have judged to have been phished. So, you know, it can lead to malware downloads and all kinds of nasty stuff. And educating the employee and educating people is still absolutely critical, because I think about, we've got all these, I think they're called digital natives coming through, and we're all really happy with sharing stuff, and we've all got online lives. But within a business, that's not necessarily the best thing to do. And even though we may all be happy with iPhones and various other gadgets as well, we're still not exposed to that much security in our day-to-day lives. Banks require passwords, but they make the experience as smooth as possible. And there's an education piece within organizations for people to understand what their role in security is. But there's probably also a bit of design work that needs to go into making sure that security is easy to do and not a complete and utter barrier as it has been in the past. But yeah, educating people about what their responsibilities are. So for example, I don't know, an engineer, she's reached 5 o'clock on a Friday and she needs to get a document over to a client. So she decides to use Skype to just upload it. The issue you have there is you're using a cloud service. You don't know how secure it is. Maybe she's not encrypted it. And then maybe you dig into the details as to why she did that. She says, well, I could have sent it over email, but my email limit's 20 megabytes and this was a huge document. And so there's some really complex issues there that need to be solved, which is more than just education. It's design and it's how we approach the way our organizations operate and run.
Yeah. As well as focusing on obviously the product that you offer, is that, do you have those kind of high-level thoughts quite a bit? Do you think about that outside, obviously, the product you're working on or just in general? And is there, partnerships, with various technologies? And is there, a voice to be heard there? And is it something that you do spend a lot of time thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, part of our mission here as Infox is to help our customers protect their critical data from internal threats, but also help educate the market in general. And that is talking about anything from password complexity and what makes a good password through to how to educate the board about what security is and what it looks like and risk management. And yeah, we spend a lot of time thinking about it because it's all interlinked. I don't think you can separate out any part from the other because it's all part of an ecosystem or a spectrum that we live on.
Interesting. Your brain certainly works in different ways to mine, that's for sure. closing kind of thoughts, it's always a fun question. Technology wise, I know you're a lover of technology as much as I probably am, if not more so. What, and it can be outside the realms of securities as well, or just something that you're personally into. What technologies do you look at the moment and that are kind of right around the corner that you're particularly excited to see happen?
Oh, yeah, there's a couple. There's quantum computing, which is fascinating. There's some really interesting stuff going on there. And the other is all aspects of machine learning and artificial intelligence. We've got our machine learning team here, and they're a fascinating bunch of guys. And really, I've learned an awful lot over the past couple of years about where it's going and some of the applications. And that's it's just a fascinating area. I think we're starting to see some really, really cool things come out of that. And I'm looking forward to seeing what comes of it.
I like it. I agree. And that's also something I'm certainly looking forward to seeing. Jamie, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thanks for taking the time. We're right at half an hour now, I think. So we timed that quite well. But thank you so much for taking the time. It's enjoyed it. Hope you did too.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. Please make sure you subscribe at iTunes or SoundCloud, or check out the website venturi-group.com and keep up to date with the latest IT jobs, talent, news, and podcasts. Or drop me a line. It's andy.davis@venturi-group.com. Any feedback, topics, or guest suggestions are always welcome. And thanks again for listening to the show. See you next time.